All right, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases to hear argument on our 10:30 docket. We have In the Interest of Maurice Bolin, and then we have Orchards on the Brazos versus Stinson. So we will hear argument one after another in those two cases. I believe the parties have checked in and announced ready and given their time to the clerk. If the clerk will announce who is arguing for us this morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Brian Thomas to argue for the appellant and cross appellee, Mr. Price Smith to argue for the appellee and cross appellant.
All right, we'll begin with in the interest of Maurice Bolin, deceased. That's cause number 2-14170-CV.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, I believe that the parties in this case have briefed virtually every issue that we could. And while I have a couple that I'd like to discuss specifically this morning, I thought I might actually begin with the end, which is to say what we would like for this court to do for Lonnie Bolin. The trial court almost got it absolutely correct, but it stopped short. We are looking for the fulfillment of justice for Lonnie Bolin this morning. We'd like for this court to affirm that Lonnie Bolin did not violate the no contest clause, affirm that he is in fact entitled to his specific inheritance that his father wanted him to have, but we would like the court to reverse and render the trial court's conclusion of law number 12, and that is that Cooper Bolin did not violate his fiduciary duty to Lonnie because of a good faith reliance on his mistaken belief that the no contest clause had been triggered and could not be untriggered. We'd like for this court to reverse that Cooper is not individually liable for his breach by self-dealing when he arbitrarily deemed that the no contest clause had been triggered by Lonnie Bolin, when he self-dealt and delivered Lonnie's portion of his inheritance to himself. We'd like for this court to grant a constructive trust at the very least over those assets of the estate that are now in Cooper Boylan's hands that should have and must now belong in Lonnie's hands. We'd also like for this court to reverse the trial court's award of prejudgment interest to correctly apply the interest on the inheritance that was withheld from Lonnie for years. Out of all the issues that we've briefed that Lonnie Bolin has presented to this court, one sticks out in my mind high and apart from the others. And that is that Lonnie Bolin never triggered the no contest clause in his father's will. The trial court was presented with a legal question and a fact question. The trial court answered both of those questions in Lonnie Boylan's favor. The legal question, was the no contest clause triggered? Well, of course it wasn't. His contest was non-suited before his father's will was ever admitted to probate. The terms of his father's will were not even operative at the time when Lonnie Boylan's opposition to the will was a live pleading. And it was only a pleading. It was not in itself proof of anything. For the benefit of the court, we discussed at length the Sheffield case, the case from which we gained this mere filing rule, that merely filing a will contest is not enough to trigger a no contest clause. And if we've relied heavily on that case throughout our briefs, it's because we think that case represents very good law in Texas. That until such time as an opponent does more than merely file a will contest, a no contest clause has not been triggered if it doesn't operate simply by merely filing. And in this case, the no contest clause is very clear. It does not contain a mere filing prohibition. It does not say that going down to the clerk and handing the clerk a pleading is enough to trigger a no contest clause. Then we have the fact question. Even if merely filing the will contest was sufficient to upset the apple cart, to trigger the no contest clause, something that couldn't be undone. Even if that was enough, even if Sheffield is wrong, did Lonnie bring his action and maintain his action in such a manner as to be found in good faith and to have been brought and maintained with just cause?
Where does the fact that some minor discovery took place come into either this legal question or this factual determination?
Your Honor, I believe it speaks probably to both, but more to the fact question. I believe it speaks to Lonnie maintaining his action, brief as it may have been, in good faith. Lonnie Boylan is, by my estimation, the best kind of will contestant. He is the epitome of good faith. It was because of that very moderate discovery that Lonnie Boylan's attorney, Mr. Briley, was able to discover facts that Lonnie did not know, could not know, and testify that he did not know and could not know. It was the result of that modest discovery that prompted Mr. Briley to write him one of the best letters I've ever seen written by a probate litigator to a client that wants to maintain a will contest. And in that letter, Mr. Briley said, "Lonnie, the deck is stacked against you. Here are prior wills that you didn't know about. They look an awful lot like the one you don't like. Here are statements from witnesses that you don't know that knew your father, and they're not saying what you think. Here's a statement from his doctor telling you things that you couldn't know that speaks against your claim that your father lacked testamentary capacity. Your Honor, I would suggest that that discovery and speaks primarily to the fact issue because it led to the exercise of Lonnie's good faith. Upon receipt of Mr. Briley's letter and at his suggestion, Lonnie Boylan stepped away. He said, gosh, if the deck is stacked against me, if I didn't know these things, and if I'm going to lose this will contest so spectacularly, I certainly don't want this no contest clause to operate against me. I'll back away. I'll dismiss my case. It's precisely what happened. Not 2 weeks later, Mr. Boylan's will was admitted to probate without objection. And at that point, every word in the document became of legal importance and of legal effect. Speaking to the executor, Cooper Boylan, from that date forward, from the day that the will was admitted to probate, Cooper was charged with fulfilling every single one of its terms, including making distribution of an inheritance to the brother that had just brought a will contest alleging awful things, that his father lacked testamentary capacity at the time that he executed the will. Even worse, alleging that Cooper Boylan unduly influenced his father into writing that will that favored Cooper more than it favored Lonnie. Cooper Boylan was forced to make a distribution to that man who just put him through litigation. And he decided not to. Cooper Boylan decided not to. Not a judge, not anybody else. Cooper Boylan woke up one day and arbitrarily decided the no contest clause must apply. There was a contest, so surely I don't have to give anything to Lonnie. Your Honors, that's a breach of his most basic duty as the executor of the will. That's a failure to make a distribution to a beneficiary who is entitled to receive one. Cooper Boylan never once pled or even alleged, let alone testified, that he made a mistake when he made that decision. Trial court found that he made a mistake, that he made it in good faith, that Cooper Boylan didn't know the law about no contest clauses, and that he made an honest mistake about whether or not he had to make any kind of a distribution to the brother that just sued him. This is a mistake of law, Your Honors. It's an affirmative defense. Never pled, never argued, and to this day, Cooper Boylan would never characterize his decision as a mistake. And so while I can appreciate the trial court's sense of wanting to dole out some hybrid justice where Lonnie wins a little bit, but Cooper doesn't lose everything, that's not what applies here, and that's not what the result should be. Cooper Boylan made the decision, with or without the advice of his counsel, and he made the decision to withhold from Lonnie that which the will told him to give to his brother. Obviously, we think that Cooper Boylan should be individually liable for his individual choice. Holding the estate liable, that is, the trial court's judgment against Cooper in his representative capacity, as opposed to his individual capacity, makes Lonnie a creditor of his father's estate. And it provides us with a landscape where the entire estate is responsible for Cooper's choice, for Cooper's wrongdoing. Your Honors, that simply isn't right. The rest of the estate, the other beneficiaries, they didn't make the choice that Cooper made. Cooper made that choice. He profited from that choice. He received more because he decided that Lonnie should receive none. And for that self-dealing, informed, uninformed, or otherwise, we're asking that Cooper Boylan be found individually liable.
You're asking this court to impose a constructive trust. Did you plead for that at the trial court level?
Your Honor, we didn't specifically use the term constructive trust. We did ask for all other equitable relief, and I don't believe that that the trial court made the correct decision to parse liability when no one, including Cooper, decided to do the same. Cooper did not deny individually that he had done the things that Lonnie said were wrong. Cooper denied in his representative capacity that he'd done nothing wrong, and the trial court decided on its own that there should be some parsing of liability, that individually he should escape, but that in his representative capacity, the estate should be found liable. And there's a larger reason why the estate is not liable. There's a larger reason why a judgment against Cooper in his representative capacity is completely ineffectual. That's because there is no estate. There is nothing left for Lonnie Boylan to execute any type of judgment against. Everything that remained in Maurice Boylan's estate that didn't go to the other specific beneficiaries went to Cooper. And it's all still there. It's just in Cooper's name. And so Lonnie's judgment, while it provides him some sense of vindication, provides him no relief whatsoever, because there's no property he can go out and seek and execute his judgment against.
You started out by telling us exactly what you were asking for. Tell us exactly what you're asking for concerning the interest issue.
Your Honor, what we're seeking is more than 1 year's worth of Lonnie's inheritance at 5%.
You're not asking for 6%. You're asking for more time at 5%.
As a matter of fact, I think what we're asking for is the 6% set at the rate set by the finance code. The question, and it's certainly one that it's not one that I'm sure I know the precise answer to. It's why that we've stated in our brief that the answer could be one or the other. We know all the important dates. We know the date that the decedent died. We know the date that the will was admitted to probate. And I believe that while the interest on the specific bequest is, by statute, designed to run from the date of death, I believe in this case, under the fact that a contest was filed preventing distribution by Lonnie, that interest should probably more likely run from the date that the will was admitted to probate. In any event, it's far more than the barely $4,000 that the trial court decided Lonnie was entitled to in prejudgment interest. This is $80,000 withheld from Lonnie Boylan 4 years, and never disclosed to him that it was being withheld from him. This action began as one for accounting and distribution. Once the facts came clear that Cooper Boylan had already distributed, it became one alleging the brazen self-dealing of Cooper Boylan. Your Honors, I see that my time is expiring. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Smith.
it please the court. Mr. Thomas, I represent Cooper Boylan, and I will tell you, I did have a sinus attack this morning, so my voice is a little strange. It's not my normal voice, but I hope you'll bear with me. First of all, I think in an analysis such as this, we have to begin with the basics. Basics meaning this, that any probate case, the focus is always on the will itself and the interpretation of that will is designed to determine the testator's intent. Now, in this case, Maurice Boylan wrote a will in 2005. He died, and the will was offered into probate. Within about 2 weeks of that application for probate, his brother, Lonnie Boylan, filed a will contest. And in this case, the will does contain a provision that I'm sure you're familiar with, but I'm going to have to read it to you anyway. I'm sorry. If any beneficiary under this will shall in any manner contest this will or any of its provisions, any share or interest in my estate given to such contesting beneficiary under this will is hereby revoked and shall be disposed of as part of the residue of my estate. Now, in the course of researching this issue, I have read many interim clauses. This one finally is very simply written, very direct, and its meaning is very difficult to misunderstand. So I would urge the court that it was Maurice Boylan's intent when he wrote the will and inserted this clause that anybody that contested his will would be disinherited. Now then, what happened in this case was that Lonnie Boylan filed his will contest in which he alleged lack of testamentary capacity and which he alleged undue influence on the part of Cooper Boylan. Now, I can assure you that you can tell from Cooper's testimony in the trial court that it was clear that Maurice Boylan was a self-made man, that he was a very strong-willed individual, and frankly was extremely mentally competent. And so the will contest worked its way through the court system for 15 months. Now then, and then at the end of that 15 months time, Lonnie Boylan did in fact non-suit his will contest. Now, the appellant in this case has relied heavily on the Sheffield case. And I frankly would like to discuss that with you here just for a moment and point out that, first of all, the Sheffield case is unique and, in fact, is quite different from this case. In the Sheffield case, the beneficiaries, first of all, were seeking filed a rather strange motion, which was to determine the testator's real intent. That was the motion that they filed. that there then after that, by the way, that motion was dismissed shortly after it was filed because of lack of standing. And then the executor in that case sought a declaratory judgment that the beneficiaries had in fact violated an interim clause. The interim clause in that case is extremely lengthy, more lengthy than most I've ever seen. And the court goes on to determine that, first of all, number one, the mere filing of a will contest, standing in and of itself, is not sufficient to trigger an interim clause. I will assure you that in this case, there is more than the mere filing of a will contest. As a matter of fact, in this case, as I told you previously, the will contest went on for 15 months, including discovery requests. And then at the end of that 15-month period of time, Donnie Boylan dismissed or non-suited his lawsuit. Now then, the Sheffield case, or since the Sheffield case, the legislature has come up with a statutory structure for forfeiture clauses, which at the time this case was heard was Section 64 of the Probate Code, subparagraphs 1 and 2. And it's written, actually, kind of in an unusual way, because that statute basically requires that provision in a will that would cause a forfeiture or avoid a devise or provision in favor of a person for bringing any court action, including a will contest, is enforceable unless in a court action determining whether the forfeiture clause should be enforced, the person who brought the action contrary to the forfeiture clause establishes by a preponderance of the evidence that unenforceable if just cause exists for the bringing of the action and the action was brought and maintained, and it says brought and maintained in good faith. I might emphasize here that in this statute the focus seems to be on actually bringing the action, and then it focuses on maintaining the action. In this case, I would contend that both of those things did occur. In other words, an action was brought and an action was maintained.
Mr. Smith, you talked about the Sheffield case and why you don't believe that that applies. What is your strongest case for your position that mistake of law is a defense to breach of fiduciary duty, even in when it has not been pled as a defense?
Your Honor, I appreciate that question, because in this case, it was not my defense of mistake of law. And I don't know, Mr. Thomas seems to believe that I did pursue that course of action, but I didn't. And I will tell you right now, I did not find any cases involving mistake of law as it relates to fiduciary responsibility.
Well, isn't that what the trial court then found, and therefore found that your client was not personally liable because he acted in good faith, which would be mistake of law?
Actually, I think the trial court found that Cooper Boylan acted in good faith, good faith, period. I think that's what the trial court was hinging its judgment on.
Okay, so where is your authority to support that a trial court can find that acting in good faith somehow absolves someone for breach of fiduciary duty?
I have not found such a case, Your Honor. I mean, I'm serious.
Okay, so you agree that the trial court erred in that finding?
No, I don't. I think the trial court believed and found that because of the evidence that was presented in the case, that Mr. Boylan acted in good faith and that his duty as a executor was that duty, which was to act towards beneficiaries in good faith. That's what I gleaned from the judgment.
But you agree that there's no case law to support?
All I can agree is I haven't found any, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry, I'm not...
No, that's fine. That's a good answer. I appreciate that.
I'm just telling you. Believe me, I've looked. Understand, I think that we're in basically uncharted waters here, mainly because the trial court found, first of all, that Lonnie did not breach the interim clause and therefore was entitled to his inheritance, and then further found that Cooper Boylan, the executor, was acting in good faith in his belief that the interim clause had been effectuated. That being the case, he did not find individual liability on Cooper Boylan's part. He did find that he was entitled to his inheritance. I can tell you, I have researched as diligently as I know how, and I have not found such a case as this one. That's the answer. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Frankly, I think that the this case exemplifies something quite unique. And I don't want to try to put my feet in the judge's shoes here. I don't know what his ultimate ulterior motive was. I do know that there was considerable evidence presented to the effect that the interim clause had been activated. I do believe that. And frankly, in my cross appeal, I am asking that the court determine that to be the case. And I will say that if you review the evidence in the case, you will discover that there is a considerable amount of evidence in favor of the fact that the interim clause had been triggered. And that includes the testimony of Lonnie Boylan, which frankly I found quite strange in this case. Lonnie Boylan testified that all he ever wanted to do was see a copy of the will. Once he saw a copy of the will, then it was cease, desist, and we weren't going to go any further. However, Steve Briley said that he sent him a copy of the will before the will contest was filed, although Lonnie says he never saw it before. Thank you. I appreciate your attention. It's always an honor to appear before this court, and I want to tell you it's been an honor today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Thomas, we'll have rebuttal now.
I tend to agree that we may be in some uncharted territory with respect to this case. But as a probate litigator, this is precisely the territory that I want to be in with this court today. Because I've seen Lonnie Boylan before, and I know I'm going to see him again and again and again, with my will contestants that in good faith want to challenge someone's will. And we placed this information at the end of our second brief, our reply brief to Cooper Boylan's cross appeal, when we discussed how the Sheffield policy promotes good faith litigation and how history could have been rewritten for Cooper to make this decision correctly, not arbitrarily, but correctly. Even the trial court, in virtually its very first words, informed the parties and counsel all of this could have been resolved if somebody had filed an action for declaratory judgment. And that is precisely what a responsible executor, someone in Cooper's shoes, should have done. It's very simple. If Lonnie Boylan files a contest, he is presumed to have done so in good faith. If he maintains that contest in good faith, we believe that the discovery requests and responses in this case are evidence of that. If he pleads his good faith, and if the proverbial deck is stacked against him and he non-suits and dismisses his claim, there is no contest if the will is then admitted to probate. But if, during that time, an executor files a counterclaim, declaratory judgment, asking the court to decide if Lonnie is bringing and has brought and is maintaining his action in good faith and with just cause, Lonnie Boylan cannot dismiss that counterclaim. The burden, as Mr. Smith has briefed for this court, rests on the contestant's shoulders with respect to good faith and just cause. Lonnie can't non-suit that claim. He can non-suit his claim and say, I don't want to test my merits. I don't want to do the something further that Sheffield says will get me in trouble and will violate this no contest clause. But in that case, Cooper has affirmatively elected to test the issue of good faith and just cause, and he is entitled to that day in court. And the facts will be what the facts will be. A cautious, reasoned executor who is willing to impose the harshest penalty upon the beneficiary to whom he owes the highest of duties welcomes that examination. He is affirmatively seeking it. And then he has the backing of a court's judgment, saying, sure, there's no good faith. There's no just cause. Withhold that inheritance all you want to. That's how no contest clauses should work. That's how Sheffield promotes how good faith will contests should proceed, should be dismissed if they need to be dismissed, should be heard if they need to be heard. That's how an executor makes this decision. Not arbitrarily, not as a form of punishment to his brother who sued him. That's how that policy works. Your Honors, thank you very much for your time and attention. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Again, thank you, Mr. Smith, as well. Gentlemen, we appreciate your briefing and your oral arguments and being here today as well. Especially, you've come a little bit of a ways, Dallas and Wichita Falls. Thank you. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. Thank you. We now call the